This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and you know the Book of Unknown Americans, Christina Henriquez's, well, first novel for some of us, not technically her first, but it was really a novel that put her on the map in a different way. And now she's written a historical novel called The Great Divide, and we are going to Panama in 1907. And, you know, Christina, as I was digging around prepping for the show, there were a couple of interviews you did where you said you were working on something new, and now I'm dying to know, because these were all around sort of 16, 17, 18 after Book of Unknown Americans had come out. And you'd had some stories published, and you were like, yeah, I'm working on a thing. And I'm wondering, was The Great Divide the thing that you were talking about?
It may have been the thing. I was working on a different thing before The Great Divide. And the different thing that I was working on utterly failed. It's somewhere in my computer, probably never to be looked at again. So, but The Great Divide was the book I had been wanting to write for like 15 years. So even before The Book of Unknown Americans, I'd been carrying around this idea just generally of writing a novel about the Panama Canal. And it took me a really long time to get to it, to actually put pen to paper. But when the other thing that I was working on spectacularly failed, it was the only other idea I had. And I thought finally, like, maybe now's the time to try to actually do it. And that seemed very scary and overwhelming because it was such a big kind of epic story. So I just spent a whole bunch of time reading, researching before I could actually kind of find my way into it. Yeah, then it took about 5 years to actually write it after I started in earnest.
Your dad is Panamanian. Panama has popped in other ways in earlier work for you. But, I mean, I know I was saying this to you before we started taping. I didn't know Panama had been part of Colombia because no one ever mentioned it to me until I read it in your book. The canal, obviously, huge feat of engineering, like not a small thing. I mean, you've got locks that move up and down, like the whole thing, but no one's ever really talked about the people the way that you have. And you sort of have three main characters, right? We've got Omar, Ada, and John, and we are going to obviously dance around major plot points. But can we talk about those three characters and why you decided on them? Because I feel like you sort of knew that you needed to have multiple POVs. I think you're really comfortable with multiple POVs as a writer. But who are these folks and what do they represent for you?
I actually didn't know at the beginning I needed so many points of view. Yeah.
Okay.
It really, so as you said, I mean, the canal, you know, is the one thing that many people associate with Panama. You know, it's like the defining kind of feature of Panama for many people. And I just wanted to tackle it and get inside of it in a different way, which to me meant, you know, everybody also hears, if they hear about the Panama Canal, it's the greatest engineering feat of all time. But it's like, what else? What's beyond that, right? And for me as a novelist, what's beyond is always the characters. That's what's interesting. Like, I write fiction to kind of try to understand, you know, what we're doing here as human beings. So I wanted to think about what would it be like to live through this monumental moment in history, but just as an ordinary person. And I started with Ada and Omar first, and that was all the novel was. And it's, so Ada is this young 16-year-old girl from Barbados who comes to Panama trying to earn money for her sister who needs a surgery that they can't afford. And Omar is a boy who lives a very solitary existence growing up in Panama, and is looking for some kind of like connection and community. And when the canal project starts kind of in his own backyard, you know, it's like a great reason to go work on it. He's going to meet all of these people from all of these countries from all over. I mean, like there were like 97 countries who had people who came and worked on the canal. And he's going to meet all of these people and be like in community with them. And that sounds exciting to him. So he goes to work on the canal. And eventually the two of them kind of intersect and meet and have a friendship that grows over the course of the book. And it really just started with them. And at the end of that draft, I thought I had the book. Like, I thought I was like, oh, okay, good. I'm done. I'm done. I wrote this book that I wanted to write. And I showed it to, well, I showed it to my then editor, who essentially had like one note, which was like, it has to be bigger. And I had then to figure out, how does it become bigger? Mm-hmm. It can become bigger. You know, if you're a novelist, it can become bigger because the span of time can increase. It can become bigger, you know, just for me, this was the solution, by including more people, like pulling more people into the fold. So I started thinking about who are the other characters that exist mm-hmm. here. And Omar, like I knew already that he had a father that had been mentioned, of course, right. in the book, but actually never even named. Like I hadn't even gone that far. It was such a sketch. It's kind of funny that I thought it was done because it just really wasn't. It was so far from done. But when I started thinking about Omar's father, I was like, okay, who is he? Starting to figure out his whole backstory, like what are his motivations? And then understanding that maybe he is not happy with Omar working on the canal and that it's this source of tension between them. You know, eventually, like little by little, that's like, okay, who is Ada's sister? Who is her mother? Like starting to branch out from those two central characters. And then little by little, the novel just kept unfolding. And then it sort of became a process of like, how do I know if I've gone too far? You know, like I just kept like bringing more and more characters under the tent. It was like, oh, now you're going to hear the point of view of this, like a coroner for, you know, one paragraph, where you're going to hear the point of view of like a doctor. And it was just sort of like, where do I stop? And one of my rules to myself was to not actually stop, to just keep okay. following it wherever it went. And so that is how I ended up with a book that then had all of these like different voices and perspectives. And then, you know, at the end of doing that, I was like, oh, of course, that was the way. Like, that's how the book had to be. And it couldn't have really been any other way. I think in order to encapsulate the richness and the scale of that story, it had to have all of those voices, but I didn't see it at first.
What I didn't also fully expect too was how many people came from places outside of Panama. I'm not talking about the Americans. Obviously, the Americans have a huge place in this story. But again, Ada's from Barbados. She's not the only person from elsewhere. There are also other kinds of workers. The range of people who migrate because there are no jobs anywhere else and they have to come here, like this is the best they can do to support their families. I mean, Ada keeps, the cook where Ada is employed is not fond mm-hmm. of Ada, let's just say that. Not fond of her at all, has her reasons, but not fond of her. But it's as if you're talking about not just colonialism, but patterns of migration, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think there are folks who, when they think of an immigrant novel, they think, oh, people coming to America. And it's like, well, you know, people can go to other parts of the Americas to start with, or people can immigrate to Europe. Like, we're not the only place where people show up. And it was one of the things I really did like about this book was just seeing who was going to show up next. And what they were going to bring to the story. And John, sort of the third piece, right? We've got Ada, we've got Omar, and then we've got this American doctor, John. He's really trying to figure out, he knows why he's there. He wants to eradicate malaria. He's got a little bit of a backstory, which for storytelling purposes, we are leaving out of this conversation. But would Ada and Omar have met if not for the American presence, right? Like,
yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, the point you're making about it being an immigration novel in a sense, right? Like that also occurred to me as I was writing it. I set off and I thought, oh, good, I'm writing something completely different from my last book. Like it's total departure. This is going to be so fun and interesting. And then like midway through, it occurred to me like, oh, no, actually, I'm writing a book with a lot of the same themes again, you know, which were themes of, immigration, home, community, belonging, all of that stuff kind of rose to the surface again in this book. And in fact, you know, Francisco, who is Omar's father, who's native Panamanian, like sees the Americans and calls them immigrants and thinks of them as immigrants. And that was borne out in my research in the literature. That was how people from Panama would refer to Americans who were coming to Panama for the canal purposes. And so that was also interesting to see. But yeah, then you have John Oswald, who's this scientist. He's like the foremost expert in mosquitoes. I had to do an enormous amount of research about mosquitoes, learned more about mosquitoes than I ever thought I would. And he comes to Panama because he's going to hopefully eradicate malaria. This is at a time, so 1907, this is just after yellow fever has actually been eradicated. And he feels like he sort of missed the boat, right? He missed like the big moment of being part of this kind of historic turning point in history. So he's at least coming to take care of malaria. He thinks it doesn't go exactly as planned. But yeah, I think then having him, I mean, there's like a pivotal moment where he interacts with Ada. There's a moment that's at that same moment where Omar is in the picture. And I'm trying not to give too much away, but he's sort of like the bridge in a way between them for a minute. And yeah, I just think that all of those perspectives ended up being necessary is what I learned.
And part of it too, I mean, going back to something you said about John and yellow fever and wanting to eradicate it, like they had the technology to eradicate yellow fever, right? We get that off the table. We're working on the Panama Canal, which is huge and, you know, an undertaking that had not really been seen before kind of thing. So here you are on the precipice of technology changing so much. And it's really jarring. It's really, really jarring. And I mean, the consequences, when you look at how everyone's approaching it, right? What are the consequences? What really does all of this mean? So structurally, when you're sitting down, right, you've got sort of an idea of where you're going. Your characters have revealed yourself. Now you're not leaving anything out. But you've still got to structure this story. You've still got to bring us through. And I want to talk about craft for a second, because this is not a small thing. I mean, you're alternating voices, you're alternating moments, you're keeping everything moving. And yeah, there's that paragraph from the coroner, and that's a really effective paragraph. And it's really effective because where it shows up in the story, and that's kind of all the guy needs to say, right? Like, we didn't need a chapter from him, but it's, yeah, when people hit it, they'll know, you'll know it when you see it. But yeah, let's talk about structure for a second and how you're creating this world and not letting the research turn this into a history book, because that's not also not what you're writing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, structure is everything, I think, when you're writing a novel, right? Like if you can, when you find the structure, you feel like you've unlocked something. I was sort of writing with structureless. Like I was like very aimless for a very long time. And I was just... I have like a general philosophy, which is like, I'm not here to tell the story. I'm here to find the story. And so I sit down and I'm always like every day kind of just pushing ever outward from whatever the last sentence was, but more in the spirit of exploration than in the spirit of like, you know, maneuvering anything. And I just kept finding more and more things. So then I just kept following more and more things. And then it became sort of like this unwieldy, you know, it's like, okay, now I've got all this stuff, but what do I do with it? Where does it all go? Like the eternal question. It was like, you know, or I would find something really interesting in the research that I was like determined to include somehow, but it's like, where does it go? And so that was always my question as I was going through. And that, you know, speaks to the structure and how do you finally structure a book? I mean, the first chapter, which is Francisco just alone on his boat, sitting on the water, he's a fisherman and he's looking out and he's trying to imagine what he's heard people say, which is that ships will one day sail through the middle of Panama. And he just sort of can't believe that that's actually a possibility. And he's trying to envision those ships. I mean, that chapter came much later, for example. Like I didn't write chronologically. I just had a bunch of stuff. And then I went back and tried to figure out like, where does it all go? And it's, you know, it's like sort of in the same way that a lot of these characters are like digging through mountains to build the canal, I sort of felt the same. Like I was like excavating this thing and like digging and just trying to like find and sometimes scaling mountains in order just to get everything where it goes. But yeah, I did have, I wrote the whole thing in notebooks by hand. And every once in a while I would stop and I would write like an instruction to myself. And one of those instructions was, you are not a tour guide. You know, as much as there were so many things that were interesting that I wanted to include, so many parts of Panama that I wanted to show, I always was trying to remind myself, characters, 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 foreground that, you know, follow the story. And if it doesn't work, it just doesn't work. It just, not everything can be included. So yeah, that was one of the things that I always tried to keep in mind, that I wasn't a tour guide, that it wasn't a textbook. It's a lot of work. And then, you know, when I'm writing it all by hand, the structure seems more nebulous because it's all just in notebook pages that are kind of crazy. And like, everything's all over the place. I wrote like diagonally, like it was unlined notebooks. So everything was like diagonal and there were arrows everywhere. And I was writing down the sides of margins and it just looked, I mean, I guess it looked like my brain on paper, but that's not always helpful then when you're trying to like order it into a book. So then eventually I would move things over to the computer and, you know, it's just that laborious process of like moving this here, moving that there, cutting this whole thing that you really loved and now it's gone. And the structure is always, always an issue.
So characters guiding you though, right? Like character is the thing that's driving the narrative. Does that mean you're reading for character too? When you're reading, not necessarily for research, but just, you know, you're living your life and reading a book.
Yeah. Even when I'm reading research for research, I'm reading for character in a certain way, right? I'm looking for the interesting facts and statistics and, you know, you need some of that stuff. Or sometimes I'm looking for something very specific. I'm looking for a street name or, you know, something like that. But oftentimes, especially in the beginning, when I was just sort of getting the lay of the land, I'm reading, trying to think about, and you could see in the margins of the books that I was reading, I'll write notes like, a character could do this, you know, or this could be, it's always like about the situation and what the characters maybe could go through.
Your dad came to the States in 71 to go to college. Your dad's Panamanian. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you've talked about in past interviews too is like, you know, and this is not unique to your family, but obviously getting stories out of our parents is not always the easiest thing. And I'm kind of enjoying this idea of you spending lots of time in Panama over summers when you were small, not really speaking Spanish, kind of watching what the adults are doing, paying attention, absorbing all of this stuff that would later get used in a novel. And I'm just wondering, like, has your dad read the book? Has he given you any thoughts on sort of the essence of the thing? Yeah.
My dad was my right-hand man through this whole thing, was sort of like my unpaid research assistant. Every time I had a question, I was calling him. He was looking things up for me. He was contacting museums in Panama and organizations. At one point, like I had a draft and I was like, I would love to read this. Like, and there's a few scholars within this area of like Panama Canal research and studies. And there was one very notable one. Her name is Melva Lowe de Gooden. She lives in Panama and she works at this museum and this organization dedicated really to like amplifying the experiences and remembering the experiences of West Indians who worked on the canal. And I wanted to somehow contact them. I think I sent a general email to their like info email, you know, address. And I hadn't heard back from anybody. And I was sort of bemoaning this to my dad. And the next thing I know, he like, I didn't know he was going to do this. He called the museum and asked them. He was like, my daughter's writing this book and she needs to talk to somebody. And can I get a phone number of Melva? And they were sort of like, what? Like, who are you? You know, what is this? And he explained a little bit more. And somehow somebody gave him Melva's phone number. And then he proceeded. This was all happening without my knowledge.
Right.
He proceeded to cold call her like on a Sunday. And she miraculously like picked up the phone And then he explained the whole thing again. My daughter's writing this novel, blah, blah. And she agreed to meet with me over Zoom and talk to me about this book. It was the most amazing thing. So then he, you know, he's calling me and saying, I got Melva's phone number. You can contact her, set up a Zoom. I was just like, what? How did that even happen? But he was amazing in that way, that he was always so supportive. And he even said to me just recently, because we had had this conversation like midway through writing it, he's like, did I ever tell you I worked on the canal? And I was like, wait, what? Like, you knew what I've been writing about and you just decided to drop this now. And he, you know, certainly not in the construction years, he's too young for that, but he had worked on the canal in the summer after high mm-hmm. school, like in dredging division. And like, I had never heard that story. And he just said to me the other day, he was like, isn't this interesting? And that you're writing this book and you keep asking me these questions. And it's like, we wouldn't have had these conversations otherwise. You know, and I think that is something that has been really special about writing it, is the way that I've been able to connect not only to my dad, but, you know, to my family in Panama. Like, my cousin was running around making photocopies for me and delivering things to people. And sort of everyone's kind of been involved in trying to get this book off the ground. That has been a really, like, cool aspect of it that I hadn't expected.
Do you have a better handle now on sort of who your family is? Because, I mean, obviously, and I've done this too, where you're just plopped somewhere else for a summer and you're just, your eyes get really big and you eat a lot and you just watch everything, right? But you have some pretty great stories about your grandfather, who sounds like a complete character, and it sounds like everything sort of revolved around him. Like, do you have a better handle on him now? And can you sort of tell people what he was about and who he was? Because I had no idea that he was this sort of kind of very big figure in Panama.
Yeah, my grandfather was a little bit, he was a larger than life kind of character person. I mean, but he had like this whole kind of character to him. My grandfather was a writer. He was a journalist first for many, many years. He had a radio program, which was really sort of like, he was doing like radio political op-eds for like 30 years. Based off the popularity of that program, he became mayor of Panama City for a year. Then he was in the Panama for a long time. He was a senator. And, you know, he was always just very outspoken, very political, had a lot of friends. They would, when I was growing up and I would, you know, we would be sitting in my grandparents' house at lunchtime and they would just leave the front door open and people would just sort of stream in and out. And my grandmother was always serving everybody food. And my grandpa would take his work shirt off and he'd just be in his undershirt and people would just come in and he would just tell stories and like talk to people and entertain people and engage with people. I have a special photograph just that I took one time of me going there and he's just sitting in a chair and he's reading like Garcia Lorca. Like, he was always reading. I think any kind of writing that I have in my mm-hmm. blood is probably traced back to him. You know, he was special. And when he died, there were like, I think two or three heads of state that like came to his funeral. Like, he was a very sort of known figure in Panama. And that was part of what helped my dad on the cold call. He like said, so he dropped my grandfather's name, I think. And that maybe was like opened a door a little bit. I think thinking about him, and I think it's not so much that I know any more about him now than I did before I started reading this book, but I do feel, and I feel this generally in every time I write about Panama, which is partly why I think I write about Panama, which is that I feel like the spirit of my family, like, come closer to me, and I feel myself come closer to Panama. You know, I grew up going there. I've been going there since I was 8 months old. But as you pointed out, you know, I went there without knowing Spanish. There was always like a little bit of a remove. I grew up in the United States, even as much time as I spent there. And so I think by writing about Panama and invoking some of those things, it's a way to connect me to all of that.
Do you know how your grandfather felt about the American presence in Panama? I mean, I assume he's left volumes and volumes of papers, but like, do you actually know?
That's, I don't know if he's left volumes and volumes of papers. This just occurred to me. My parents are going to Panama, and I said to them, I said, maybe what we need to do is go to the National Library and see what's archived there of his work. Because I have a short story collection that he wrote in Spanish, and it's on my bookshelf. But beyond that, I've not read any of his actual writing or listened to any of his radio programs. I don't know how we can find them. So maybe we're going to unearth them, and that would be really exciting.
That could be a fun project.
That could be a next book. I don't know. Yeah.
I can see your dad hovering in the background of that one too. But I'm also thinking in general, like, you know, as an American, my entire understanding of Panama, it really is centered around the canal. I mean, we're just not taught a whole lot about Central America outside of, you know, the questionable things that the U.S. did for a really long time. I mean, if you look at Noriega, right, it's, yeah, we did a lot of stuff. I'm trying to choose my words carefully.
No, I think that the reason that people associate the canal so strongly with Panama, besides the fact, obviously, it's called the Panama Canal, but it is as much as it's a part of Panamanian history, it's a seminal moment in American history or the history of the United States. So I don't think it's any accident that that's the thing that as Americans, as people from the United States, we know about Panama so much. The fact that we don't know the full story of it is a different kind of matter, but just knowing that it exists and that it's tethered to the United States history in some way, I think that's something that people generally know. But yeah, there's so much more. As you said, that, you know, that Panama is part of Colombia is not something that a lot of people know. On the canal project itself, the fact that there were workers from so many different nationalities, I think, is not something that people know. The fact that the canal zone, that entire space around the canal, was so racially segregated is not something that people know, you know. And so those are all sorts of things that I hope, again, through character, through story, you start to like understand about this space and that time, you know, not in a didactic kind of lecturing way, but just as the course of the novel unfolds, you start to realize, oh, this is actually what it was like there.
Yeah, I like that metaphor you were using earlier of excavation and just sort of examination and not necessarily manipulating the characters or the story to do what you need it to do. And I mean, you've been writing for a while. You have an MFA from Iowa, which of course is one of the best programs out there if you are going to do. And I mean, Ayanna Mathis comes out of Iowa and Justin Torres comes out of Iowa. Like, and that's off the top of my head. And of course I'm missing, oh, Angela Flournoy comes out of Iowa. I mean, there are some really interesting writers. Marilyn Robinson teaches there.
Mm-hmm. She was my teacher.
Okay. So we might have to talk about it because she's pretty amazing and has a really distinct worldview.
Yeah.
Right. I get excited just sort of thinking about her work.
She's one of my favorites. I had a friend of mine made a bracelet for me that says like WWMRD, what would Marilyn Robinson do? You know, it's like, I'm always like, oh, Marilyn. Yeah.
But the idea that you have this much freedom as you're figuring it out, right? Like you do not sit down, you don't outline, you don't necessarily have the spine of the thing, right, until you start working. How does that come out of an MFA program? I mean, I thought the whole point of going away for a couple of years to do nothing but the work is to do nothing but the work, right? Mm-hmm. And then here you are saying, well, you know, I have this idea and I'm just going to noodle for a little bit and sort of the characters will lead me through. How do you balance that? How do you make sense?
Well, it took a long time to get to that style of working, okay. I think. Like when I came out of Iowa, I mean, I had an amazing experience there. But I came out of Iowa writing short stories because that's what I had been versed in while I was there. I had learned by that point to stop having so much control over what those stories would be. So there was a point in my early writing career, maybe even pre-Iowa, where the way I was writing stories was just like have an idea, think about it for a while, think, okay, this is the beginning, this will be the middle, and this will be the end, and then sit down and write that story. And then at some point in graduate school, I sort of made a conscious choice to try it differently, to have a different approach. And I decided to write a sentence without knowing anything that was going to happen after that sentence. And then to just write a second sentence that responded to the first sentence in some way. And if you're doing it, like if you're on the right track, then the first sentence has some kind of questions embedded in it naturally that you need to answer in the second sentence. Not that the first sentence is interrogative necessarily, but you know, if you say he walked, which, and the sentence could really be as simple as that. It's like, well, who is he? Where is he walking? Why is he walking? Right? You have to start answering those kinds of questions. And you don't stop to think about it necessarily. It's not like at every turn I'm stopping, asking myself, thinking, you know, a lot of it's just based on instinct. You just kind of keep writing, building it out. You're like making a path, but you're laying a stone one at a time and you're building the path at the same time that you're following it. And I started writing stories like that. And I think that was kind of the way then that I could eventually get to the place where I am now, which is to have the faith, right? Which is what it takes to write without knowing where you're going, write without any kind of structure or any kind of outline. Believe that that's a better way somehow because it will give you what you need if you pay attention to it. And then in the later stages, after you have all of this material, that's when you can start plotting, planning, shaping, reshaping, making it feel purposeful and whole and round, you know, all of the things that you want that make it feel like satisfying fiction. That can all come later. But in the generative stage, I think for me, what I've found is that it's important to kind of know actually as little as possible and just let it showing itself to me on the page.
So in addition to Marilynne Robinson, who are some of the other writers who've made you Christina Enriquez?
It's like impossible to say, isn't it? I think everything gets in there somehow. I mean, I can tell you the books that have like knocked my socks off, that have like meant something to me where it has felt like, whoa, that I will think of fiction differently after that, right? And they're maybe not the books that people expect. I remember reading 60 Stories by Donald Barthelme and just being like, whoa, like, you know, sort of a life-changing kind of feeling. I remember when Pastoralia first came out, like when the story came out in the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And I had a job at the time and I was sitting at my desk and I read that story and I just like ran down the hall to a friend who also was a reader. And I was like, you have to read this. This is, what is this? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, I love Marilynne. I basically, if she wrote like a grocery list, I would read it. Mm-hmm. Like I'd read anything that she writes. There's a nonfiction writer who I really love named Eula Biss, who I just think her writing, there's something in her writing that feels very exploratory. She's always sort of like probing, searching, and I think I respond to that in her work. I mean, I've told this story many times, but the first time that I read anything from The House on Mango Street, which is, I didn't read it until I was in graduate school, but when I read that, that certainly opened, if not a door, like a whole hallway of doors for me and gave me permission to, I think, write about things that I didn't know people wanted to hear about or cared about in any way. So that was a big one. I mean, Slaughterhouse-Five is like one of my favorite books of all time. Like, you know, these are just like, I don't know if there's a lineage that you, like if there's a direct line that you can draw from those things to my work. But I mean, I just read, I know you did an interview with Paul Harding. I mean, I loved this other Eden, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, I learned approximately 58 new words from reading it. Like, it was like, what is he doing here? But like, that's why I read. Like, I enjoy plot, But I actually feel like mostly I read for language. I want someone to like break something open in even the smallest way. I just want it to feel like, oh, that's new. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. The book that I was my companion as I was writing The Great Divide was The Known World by Edward P. Jones.
I love that book. I mean, I just love everything that Edward P. Jones does, but.
Yeah, same. And I kept it. It was like on my desk. And every morning I would read like 3 pages of it, just enough to feel like nourished by it. And then I would turn to my own writing. And many of the things that he does in that book, like the flash forwards that he's able to achieve so that you can kind of feel the end of a character's arc, are things then that I learned and was able to try to do in The Great Divide. But yeah, I mean, to me, that book's a masterpiece.
Manipulating time, right? That's like, we can do that with books in a way that you can't necessarily do in other forms of art, right? Also the interiority. Those are the things. And I read for language first, absolutely. Like, I don't need to like characters and I don't necessarily need stuff to happen. All of these things are a bonus, but for me, it starts with the language. And I think language is the thing that without language, you can't really capture time and interiority in a way that is special to books. The idea, right, and Harding actually, this other Eden is a really good example of this, right? Like he's got that epic sort of Melvillian, biblical, August Wilson piano lesson kind of thing happening, right, on all these different levels. There's a little Jesmond Ward happening too. Like he's nodding to all of the places that you would think a book like mm-hmm. This Other Eden would nod to. But man, those sentences, right? Like,
yeah.
They're crazy. No, they're,
and like, I will like be reading a book and I will stop myself. If the language is just so beautiful, I will stop myself and just read it out loud. Like those few sentences, just to like hear them. Or if the choice is so audacious, like in The Known World, there's a part where it goes into the point of view of like the mule for like one line. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, why is this happening? And I love it so much. And I want to like how does that work? And like, why, you know, like I'm always trying to learn stuff like that from other writers, I think, you know, or like, I'm looking at a sentence and I'm thinking to myself, oh, I would have stopped this sentence here. So why does this sentence go on for, you know, 4 more clauses? Oh, it's because it does this when it keeps going on. So that's something to learn from. That's to me like the joy. The joy of reading and writing is like just that, of like getting really into the weeds of a specific sentence. And, you know, you talked about language. Like, I think I cannot find my way into a story or any piece of fiction that I'm writing unless I can hear the language of it. Like right now I have a vague idea for the next thing, whatever the next book is, but it's just like so vague. And I told my husband the other day, I said, it isn't coming yet because I can't hear it yet.
Right.
You know, and unless I have the actual words, I just can't find my way into it.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at notes I made while you were talking about, you know, everything from Bartlemy down through The Known World. And it's like, well, voice, right? You and I are talking about voice. And voice is the thing that you can't lose hold of. Like, if there's no voice, there's no swing for me, right? And one of the things that you do in The Great Divide that's so interesting is how you create the sort of overarching voice out of third person, multiple narrators, and yet even though everyone's bringing, like, there's some secondary characters. There's a foreman. There's a spout. Like, there are some people who, they don't need to pop more than they do, right? Like, Ada's dad, right? Ada's mom. Ada's mom has a suitor. All of these people. Yeah. And yet, we're always pushing forward, right? We're pushing forward in time. We're pushing forward in story. And the voice is really wonderfully present, even though we have all of these different POVs. And I mean, that's what I think of when you sort of rattle off everything from Bartlemy to Saunders to Slaughterhouse Five. I'm like, yeah, it's voice. Cisneros, it's voice. It's all like, the voice has to be authentic. The voice, and yes, I mean, Slaughterhouse Five is essentially a fantasy, a sci-fi, whatever you want to call it. It is its own thing, but it has a deeply authentic voice that belongs only to Vonnegut, only to that book kind of thing. And I think that's kind of cool. If you think about how widely you could read if you chose to, you could learn a ton.
Learn a ton. I know, it's endless. I know. This is why you walk into a bookstore and it's like heaven. You're like, ah. Right? Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to ask the question I'm about to ask, given everything you've said about, well, I'm excavating as I go, but I still feel like it's possible as the writer to be surprised as you're creating this world. And I'm just wondering, if you're willing to talk about any of the surprises that happen, if we can do it actually without giving away any storylines. I think we can.
I mean, some of it was those kind of large scale surprises, like things that I didn't even really know, you know, that people don't know and that I was learning along the way too. Some of it was that sort of at the historical kind of level were things that were surprising to me. Some of it was very small things that were surprising to me, but a lot of it, the best surprises as a writer are the surprises of story, you know. So I mentioned that the book starts with Francisco, this fisherman, Omar's father, is sitting alone on a boat trying to envision this world that it seems so implausible to him that it will ever exist. You know, how are they actually going to sail through the mountains of Panama, right in the middle like that? Boats will never come through, ships will never come through. So it starts with that. But then there's this moment, I remember I had this day where, this writing day, where there's a part later in the book that was like, he's able to see, he's able to envision all the things that he couldn't. And when that happened, it wasn't something I had planned. It wasn't like I thought, oh, this is a plot point that needs to, you know, occur at some point for the book to feel satisfying to readers. It just happened. And it was surprising to me that suddenly Francisco could see this. But like, it sounds so crazy. I think it sounds weird to people if they're not writers, if they haven't like gone through this practice themselves, maybe. Because it sounds, I think, to people like, well, you're the author, like just make it happen or don't make it happen. But I think if you really have this kind of intimacy and you're in tune with the writing in a different kind of way, then it isn't that you're in charge of it necessarily. And so when it happened and he was able suddenly to like envision a whole new world that he hadn't been able to envision, you know, 150 pages earlier, that was actually surprising to me, but in the best way. Like, it was like, I wrote that scene of then him like being able to see all of this. And I was just like, well, that was like a magical writing day. Like, that's the kind of stuff you're hoping for, you know, where it feels like something beyond you is working in a way that makes everything come together in ways that you couldn't have planned, really.
Okay, so the flip side of that is something that you and I were talking about briefly before we started recording. And it's something that happens at the end, and obviously I'm not going to spoil the end, but something I thought was going to happen between a couple of characters, actually. Let's say you zigged when I thought you were going to zag, right? Okay. And you just sort of said, well, that was a controversial choice. And I'm trying to figure out if you and I can talk about this without giving anything away, because part of me is just like, well, I'm kind of bummed to hear it was a controversial choice, because to me it felt organic. It felt like the only, I was so pleasantly surprised.
Well,
when
I'm happy to hear
it was
you say
true.
That.
It was so true to the person who does the thing. And it sounds like it's the exact, it's either a piece of what you just described for Francisco's father, or it's the complete opposite. And I'm not entirely sure, because obviously, you know, it's your head.
No, for me, it was always the thing that you're referring to was always a natural outgrowth of this character.
Okay.
Like I was like, this is how it has to be. Okay. And then there was some pushback from various people who were reading, you know, I'm giving the book to people, getting feedback from readers. And there were a number of people who thought it should go in the other direction. And I was sort of like listening to them, trying to understand that, receive it, take it in. Mm-hmm. But also just felt very, very adamant, like, no, like this makes much more sense to me. And if I go the other direction, I felt like it went into some kind of trappings and pitfalls that I just didn't want to get into. Like it just became a different thing, the book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I just didn't want it to become that. And so part of it is me. But when I say I didn't want it, I think it isn't so much my like authorly ego not wanting it. I think it really was more like, this is the outgrowth of all this foundational work that I've already done. Like, this is who this character is. And for me, when I'm listening to that character, it makes sense that this thing would happen, not the other one.
Did writing this book change you? Did writing The Great Divide change you as a person, as a writer?
I think so. I think I was so stuck before I started writing this book. And I really felt like a little bit scared, a little bit frightened of like, am I going to write another book? Like, what will happen? You know, everyone, I think you always have that, right? Like, even right now, I'm like, what's happening next? I don't actually know. Will it happen? Who knows? But I think I was so stuck. And then to come from that feeling to writing this book that I've described this before, but this is really true. It was the most joyful writing experience of my career. I think that can't help but change you. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt just so engaged with the thing that I get to do, which is like this dreamy thing. I mean, it's amazing for me every day that I get to wake up and do this, right? And I felt like so energized by it. And I felt so full of like, I don't know, faith for, again, what sort of what's next. You never really know. But it made me feel more like, I know that everything's going to be okay. You know, if I had that experience, I can have that experience again, maybe. I think it did change me. I also will say, though, that the other way that it changed me is like, I finished it and I was like, I am never writing a historical novel again. So, because it's just so much, you get so, like, it was a lot. It was beautiful and wonderful and amazing to learn all of this stuff. But part of me just wants now to write something that has no basis in like any kind of reality history. Like, it's just like, I just want to rely on my imagination and see what happens, see where that takes me. But the other thing I think is I will never draft on a computer again. I think the experience of writing by hand is part of what made it joyful, because there was this real, I mean, the only way I can think to describe it was like an intimacy between me and the page. You know, my computer wasn't nowhere in sight. My phone was nowhere in sight. I would just wake up in like pre-dawn and I would have a turn on the light and have my notebook and a pen. And I would like hunch over the paper. And I was just felt like so close, physically close, but like spiritually close to the story, to the characters. And it was such a pleasure to write that way. And I don't think I'll go back to writing on a computer, you know, in those early stages. Eventually, when editing, it's on the computer. But
you know, that seems like a really great place to end the show, because I know you and I could keep going, but I do like that image. Christina, thank you so much for joining us on Poured Over. The Great Divide is out now, and The Book of Unknown Americans, of course, is available in paperback if you haven't already read it. Thank you.
Hello, readers. It's time for another TBR Top Off. We're going to recommend some fantastic books to pick up when you stop in for your copy of The Great Divide. I'm Mark at my Barnes & Noble in Cincinnati, but I've got two fantastic booksellers who are going to recommend for me, and we're going to kick things off with Mary. Hello, Mary.
Hi. So I gravitated to the tumultuous aspect of The Great Divide, where a country is being divided up and no one is sure how to reconcile the new. So my pick for TBR Top Off is When We Left Cuba by Chanel Clayton. The book opens in November of 2016. We meet Beatriz Perez, and who is popping champagne at the news that Fidel Castro is dead. So someone sent her the champagne. We don't know who. Beatriz takes us back to Cuba in 1958. We meet the rest of her family. The Perez family are sugar barons, and they have been for many generations. They are the upper crust of Cuban society. There's a revolution between the government going on right now and the rebels led by Fidel Castro. The family is on shifting sands. They don't know if they should stay, if they should leave, if they should make a deal with whatever new government is formed. Beatriz's twin brother is murdered by Castro's men, and the family flees to Miami, and they live life in luxury exile. Beatriz, you know, has a different idea. She basically wants to avenge her brother's death and her country, and she does not care what means she goes through to do that. So if that means throwing away love, if that means not becoming a society woman like her mother and her sisters, whatever needs to be done. Chanel Clayton mixes history and a really good narrative, and basically the story of one woman's journey to avenge her brother and her country and her family and her way of life. So my pick for TBR Top Off is Chanel Clayton's When We Left Cuba. Jamie, what do you have for
us? When I thought about what a big in scope story The Great Divide is, I immediately thought of another book that focuses on kind of the multitude of people who are swept up into the construction of these big projects. I remember going to Biltmore Estate with my husband years ago, and they talked about how many people, the whole town had to be built to support the building of that, right? And so I thought of another book that was really about one of these wonders. It is about the construction of a magnificent Gothic cathedral. It's The Pillars of the Earth by Ken Follett. And this one is near and dear to my heart, really. So, but as in Christina Henriquez's novel, this book is both is about and is not about an engineering marvel, right? It's certainly true that Mr. Follett, you know, was exacting in his research and in his architectural detail. He wrote another book that's just about the cathedrals that he sat in while he was writing this series. But the project itself is also the setting for a story, large and small, that involves the workers, their families, the politicians. Obviously, the church in this case is a major player. There's romance, there's danger, there's ambition and suspense. All of that is present with this beautiful and interesting setting. And this was Follett's first non-mystery book that he published. And it has one of the greatest opening lines of any novel. I always have to point it out to customers. And that is, the small boys came early to the hanging. So it opens with some kids watching a hanging, which that's exciting. So in our story, we follow the stonemason. His name is Tom Builder. He's literally a builder. He's a skilled artisan. And he's got big dreams, and he comes from humble circumstances. There's a tragedy in his life, and it kind of sets him on a path toward the monastery of Kingsbridge. And there he meets a really ambitious prior named Prior Philip, and Prior Philip hires Tom to build him a cathedral. And Tom's story is really deeply affecting. It's full of beauty. It's got heartache and love for his work and his family. But pretty soon the project, which obviously is never going to be completed in his lifetime, this is a massive cathedral, right? It just becomes part of this sprawling story full of political maneuvering and intrigue and really the ultra-powerful 12th century church in England. The stakes keep getting higher and higher, and there's real danger for the residents of Kingsbridge and for the builders as they race to complete the construction. It's a physically massive book. It's very long. But it never feels slow, I think, because Ken Follett has that background as a thriller novelist, so it really does move. So it's a 900-plus page turner, I promise, and an excellent recommendation for readers who love deeply researched historical fiction with complex characters and a very satisfying plot. And so that is, again, that's the Pillars of the Earth, which is book one in a series by Ken Follett.
Love it. Love them both. Fantastic job, as expected. Yeah. Thank you very much. But that's all we have for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to Poured Over. Please make sure to give us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on our socials at Barnes & Noble. Mary, where can we find you?
You can follow us at BN Beaumont TX.
And Jamie, where can we find you?
I'm at BN Leewood KS.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Happy reading. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.